Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. And hello, Louisville. With this edition, we're excited to begin airing on WFPL. If you're hearing Eastern Standard for the first time and you want to know more about this program, you can find all of our information online at esweku.org. And thank you, WFPL, for adding us to your lineup of fine public radio programming. We really appreciate it. Later in the hour on this week's edition, our series, The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril, and the Influence of Artificial Intelligence on Professional Journalism, and a comeback for the Appalachian art and craft of weaving. First, the back-to-back Scotia coal mine disasters. It's been a half century, and we remember. In 1976, Bill Bishop, who would go on to become a columnist for the Lexington Herald Leader and then the Austin American Statesman, was working at the Mountain Eagle, the local paper in Whitesburg, Kentucky. And one day, during that time, Bill found himself reporting on a nightmare that, to this day, haunts those who are still around to remember what happened at the Scotia coal mine in Oven Fork, about 10 miles south of Whitesburg. Now, 50 years later after it happened, he recalls the experience in an article for the Kentucky Lantern, and Bill joins us to talk about it. Welcome, Bill Bishop.
Hi, thank you.
So your account of what happened on the morning of March 9th, 1976, down in the Blue Diamond Coal Company's Scotia Mine in Oven Fork, begins when mine foreman Virgil Coots called to the surface saying, "You've cut off all my air." What stands out to you about the urgency in those words and what they suggest about what was going on underground?
Well, they told us that things were not right, but we knew that because at 11:30 that morning, 15 minutes after Virgil made that call, the mine exploded. And the explosion came from an accumulation of methane gas, which is a natural thing that comes out of every coal mine. The Scotia mine was particularly gassy, and methane gas is odorless and tasteless, and you don't know it's there unless you test for it, and it is explosive. And that was the fuel that exploded inside Scotia.
So the mine was about 10 miles away from where you were. How did you first find out about it?
Oh, it was Tuesday at the Mountain Eagle, which back then was just a madcap day because we were putting the paper together. And back then you were laying out headlines and, you know, trying to find little pieces of art for the A&P ad and typing up all the columnists that sent their news from various places in Letcher County. We would normally work all night Tuesday and finish sometime Wednesday morning. But when the call came in, we knew everything had to come to a stop. And Tom and Pat Gish, the owners of the paper there, just said, "Okay, let's everybody out. Let's find out what happened in Scotia."
Well, as you mentioned, it was a gassy mine, and you write that methane built up in a dead-end section after fresh air was directed away from a place where nobody was working. For our listeners who've never been in a coal mine, can you describe how a change in that airflow can turn one section into what you call an unexploded bomb?
Methane was particularly abundant in that dead-end section. In fact, previous to that, there were these feeders that caught fire and just were flaming out the side of the mine. And what we discovered happened, and what miners on previous shifts told us was commonplace, was that the company would shift air around. There wasn't enough air to sweep everything out of the mine. So they would shift the air around to where people were working. And sometime before the explosion, air was cut off to that dead-end section. So the methane accumulated in that dead-end section, and then it was just waiting for some spark, any spark, to set it off.
And you point out in your piece that methane becomes explosive in a specific range, 5% to 15%, and then all it takes is a spark. Is there any idea where that spark came from?
The assumption at the time was that two guys were driving, they were going to reopen that section of the mine. And two fellows drove a locomotive into that section with some equipment or stuff they needed to reopen the mine with. And the motor was sparking here and there and everywhere. And there is even some thought that perhaps as the air was cut off, the amount of methane increased above 15%, which renders it inert. These mines would have what they called curtains that would direct ventilation. And as the guys took the curtains down, that allowed some fresh air to go in, diluting the methane, getting it within that 5 to 15% range. The motor provided the spark, and that was the explosion.
Well, miners told the Mountain Eagle that there's never been enough air in there. And when you heard that, what did they reveal to you about what workers have been living with day after day before the explosion?
They knew it was an unsafe mine, and it really worked on these guys. And in fact, one of the miners who worked on the ship before told his wife that he kept hearing voices of the miners who died that day. And about a week after the explosion, that miner shot himself and committed suicide.
Wow. When you got to the mine in Oven 4, families and miners, of course, were there. What did you observe about how families were receiving information? Who had answers, who didn't, and how uncertainty moved through that crowd?
Well, I mean, nobody had answers at that time. And it was just, as my memory, this is 50 years ago, and the guy with a bad memory. So things were chaotic. What they did was they sequestered family members who were, you know, you could tell were absolutely distraught. They put them in the bathhouse. And this would have been the house, the place where miners took off their city clothes, country clothes, and put on their mining clothes. And what they would do is put their clean clothes in baskets that would then be raised to the top of the bathhouse on a pulley system. And so you had these families waiting for news, standing underneath the clothing that their husbands and brothers and fathers had worn to work that day.
You report that the Kentucky State Police took your film. What did that confrontation feel like, and how did it shape what you could document in the immediate aftermath?
It was strange, and I can remember that. I mean, they did come down, and they said that the Scotia Coal Company asked that nobody take pictures and the film be taken. And so the state police said that they were doing this on behalf of the coal company. And we were on the on coal company property. My only, and I gave them the film, but my only out was I at least figured out how to rewind the film back into the canister so that when I opened the back of the camera, this was during film days, nothing got exposed. And as soon as Tom Gish heard about this, he was on the phone to Governor Carroll. Julian Carroll was governor then, just raising, you know, holy this about film being taken. The same thing happened to some filmmakers at Apple Shop. And later that day, we all got our film back.
What about the Federal Mine Enforcement and Safety Administration? When did they show up on the scene, and what changed when they got there?
Well, they took over the scene immediately, and the director, Robert Barrett, it was the Mine Enforcement and Safety Administration at that time, they took over the scene, and they were in charge.
So by 1:30 in the morning on Wednesday, rescue teams had found 15 bodies 4.5 miles from the portal to the mine. When you learned that distance, 4.5 miles in, what did it make you understand about the scale of this mine and the difficulty of rescue?
It was a deep mine, and so they were, you know, 4.5 miles underground. And the disturbing thing that we learned, and actually learned this from interviews with funeral home operators, is that all miners carry self-rescuing devices that turn carbon monoxide into oxygen. And six of the miners had cracked open their self-rescuers and had put them in their mouths. And for a time, were breathing this. They survived the initial explosion, and they could have walked out. It was only 3,000 feet to fresh air, but they would have seen damage. They could have seen the bodies of their co-workers. And so they barricaded themselves and waited for help. And the thing about self-rescuing devices at that time was that they would heat up. And those miners showed blistering around their lips because they were hanging on until the last bit of oxygen was gone out of those rescuers.
Now, back at the paper at the Mountain Eagle, you described journalists arriving and even an Associated Press photographer setting up in your darkroom. On that first day, how did the presence of outside media kind of change the rhythm that was going on in that newsroom and your sense of responsibility as local witnesses?
The Eagle was used to having visitors. And so Tom and Pat brought in food, and everybody found a desk, and Tom was particularly, he was proud that a reporter for a very major newspaper called in his first day story, holding in his lap the pasted up front page of the Mountain Eagle. He was sort of reading off that and calling in his story. But it was very cooperative, and like in all disasters, people work together.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lasting impression, Bill, that came to mind when you began your recollection in writing this article, something that really stands out to you?
What stood out to me was how there were heroes in this story. The widows of the first explosion were heroic. The mine rescue people were heroic. The heroes in this story were not our leaders. They weren't our members of Congress or Senate. They weren't the governor or the, they were the people that live and work in that place. And to me, that was inspiring.
You've been listening to Bill Bishop, and you can read Bill's full account of the March 9th, 1976 Scotia mine explosion online at Kentucky Lantern, one word, KentuckyLantern.com. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.
And sadly, the story doesn't end there. Dr. Brian McKnight, a professor of history at the University of Virginia Wise, joins us to pick up the account of what happened at the Scotia mine near Whitesburg 60 hours after the March 9th explosion. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Thank you.
So it's now March 11th, 1976, and the region around the Scotia coal mine is reeling in the early stages of grief and coming to grips with the explosion that happened 2 days earlier. Rescue and recovery teams are there. They're from all over the area, and federal mine inspectors and officials have arrived on the scene. Tell us what happened on the 11th.
Well, actually, they thought everything was over. They said the mine has blown up. We've kind of got everything under control here. Mesa's come in. They've taken over. And this happens at about 11:30 p.m., middle of the night. Suddenly, the second explosion takes place. Everybody's thrown into turmoil because of this happening a second time. Mine rescue teams are being called out, and they're like, this is crazy. You know, we're being called out. We were just out there. And then when they hear that it's the same mine, they're really scared, because usually a mine will blow up one time and then everything kind of normalizes and stabilizes. But they say, it's been how long now? And I joke, these mine rescue guys, they're doing math. They're like, it's been how many hours? So how many hours do we have to be scared of? You know, when should I start getting nervous again? And that's what happens. I mean, it becomes just a cauldron of activity again, and it was some real terror attached.
And the whole thing was scary, of course, and there are many aspects of that we could go into, but one in particular really grabbed my attention, and that was what you told us about this 13.5-foot borehole that went down into the mine about 375 feet down. Tell us about that and why that comes into play here.
That mine was pretty extensive. It was 4.5 miles from the outside to where the first explosion took place. What the Scotia company had come up with the year before, they said, you know, we're having to spend an hour getting guys in there on the clock, and then we're having to pay them an hour to come out. So we're really only getting 6 out of 8 hours production. Let's drill a borehole. It'll provide added ventilation, and we can put an elevator down there, and we can get them right to work at the working face, save us tons of wages that are spent on transportation, and ultimately it won't take long for that elevator to pay for itself.
You mentioned ventilation, and that really comes into play in this story. As I understand it, Scotia was quite gassy.
It was a gassy mine, and the company never really had enough fans pushing enough air to provide decent ventilation. It was a long-standing problem.
Okay, so they decide to send rescuers down that hole on a pretty rickety elevator, if you will. Tell us a little bit about that. I understand it was attached to a crane.
It was attached to a borrowed crane, so you don't even know about how well this crane is maintained. One of the guys said that that the cog was missing a tooth. And he said every time it turned, it dropped you a little bit. And they're scared to death anyway. They said it was a little bitty cable about the size of your pinky holding up a cage with three guys in it, which was actually an improvement because they first thought about doing a 55-gallon drum. But they threw a cage together. And they would load them down three at a time. And you know, you had two Westmoreland Mine Rescue teams. You had one National Mines backup team down there. This is 6 people per team. That's 18 people. Not counting all the Mesa people at the bottom, that's another 6 or 8. You've got 24, 25 people down there, and they can only go down and come up 3 at a time. So if there is an emergency, what are you really going to do? You're not going to get them out of there.
So specifically March 11th, and you were talking about those rescuers and others going down into the mine. What happened that day down in the mine?
Well, that's the subject of a lot of speculation. The mine rescuers believed, and still believe to a degree, that the same cause of the first explosion caused the second explosion. That's not true, but we didn't know that because that file was sealed for 17 years. So we didn't know that for a very long time. Whatever happened, something caused a spark. An explosion a lot more powerful than the first one took place. And in the meantime, between the first explosion and the second explosion, Scotia had sent 10 men down there to help these MESA, Mine Enforcement Safety Administration inspectors, help them remediate the mine. So you had a lot of people underground to an extent, but right there where that second explosion takes place, you had 10 Scotia employees and you had 3 federal inspectors. 2 of those Scotia employees survived that explosion. They're away from the main group. But the other 11 end up getting killed in that second explosion.
Well, after that happened, that second explosion, it was then decided to seal the mine with the bodies still in it. And the mine remained sealed for 243 days until it was eventually reopened and the bodies finally recovered. How did that prolonged time of waiting play out up on the surface among families?
Oh, it was terrible. You got to understand, the Farmington disaster in West Virginia took place in 1968, 1969. At the time, there were still 70 or 80 of the men who were killed at Farmington still underground. Even today, 2026, there I think 19 of those folks are still underground at Farmington. So these family members really thought that they were never going to get their loved ones back. And they were paranoid. They were skeptical. They didn't believe Mesa. And they thought, well, you know, Mesa may be working with Scotia to hide the evidence, to hide what's happened here. But there was a lot of tension, a lot of paranoia a lot of frustration, a lot of anger that basically manifests itself throughout that time.
And I imagine that even if it's just intuitive, you're looking for some kind of closure, and that certainly would impede that.
Oh, certainly so, particularly with stories that the Westmoreland mine rescuers didn't actually go see the bodies, which they did. But you know, when people are angry and when they're frustrated and they're absolutely powerless, they react that way. Mm-hmm. And so it should be somewhat expected.
Well, you write that the Mine Safety and Health Act, passed a year after Scotia, was the first mine law that came with teeth in it. What made it stronger than previous law?
Well, previous law, and I'm really going back before the Coal Act of 1970, basically the mine inspectors had no power at all. They could basically say, you're going to get somebody killed if you don't change what you're doing, but they couldn't do anything about it. You have the Hayden explosion, Hurricane Creek in 1970. You have the Coal Act coming as a result of that. It tries to strengthen, put teeth in, but you've got guys who have never really had the authority, the enforcement authority, being told you've got to figure something out. What happened at Scotia happened largely because federal mine inspectors didn't really have a way to enforce the laws that were on the books. And the Coal Act, when it is passed, it really finally says you have enforcement authority. You will get backed up on this. We are expecting that mine owners are not going to be happy about this, but we are going to stand up for you.
And has it made a difference?
Huge difference. Mm-hmm. Between the Hurricane Creek explosion in 1970 in Scotia, we're talking 6 years, there were 102 people killed in mine accidents. Between 1976 and 1984, there are 102 people killed in mine accidents. Between 1984 and 2006, there are 102 people killed in mine accidents. We haven't reached another 102 since 2006. So we went from 5 or 6 years killing 100 to 20 plus years killing 100.
Mm-hmm. Brian, how did your research into the Scotia mine disaster affect what you understand about courage and who were the real heroes in this disaster?
Well, I tell you what, you know, we live in our world and we see police officers and firemen and we see soldiers and we see courage and heroism there. But there's a different kind. These people were not getting paid for their heroism and their courage. These mine rescue guys were coal miners. They were volunteers. When these guys went over there and risked their lives twice, and the Westmoreland guys actually went in over the course of 20 years or so, they went into 5 exploded mines, the most of any mine rescue team that I'm aware of. They never got anything for it. They didn't get paid extra for it. They didn't get time off for it. They would go to these training exercises and be able to eat and drink on the company dime, but that was the extent of it. The families suffered incredibly. Ultimately, those families got a settlement that made life a good bit easier, made that loss a bit easier to handle. But even some of those families, like the families of the 3 mine inspectors, they weren't privy to those multimillion-dollar settlements. They got $13,000 in life insurance or $30,000 in life insurance.
And wasn't there something a little questionable about the judge in that case?
Oh, there was something hugely questionable about the judge. The judge was a federal judge, young guy, but he apparently had coal interest. He was getting paid lease money for a coal company operating on his land. And it's very interesting the way this actually worked out. And I talked to Geraldine McKnight King, whose husband was killed in the first explosion, and she laid this out. The judge had a habit of talking a little too much when he got around his political friends. And Jim King was chief of staff for Wendell Ford, a very powerful senator. And the judge basically said, yes, I've got a coal company operating on my land. When Geraldine heard about this and she told her attorney, about it, he basically said, gosh, that's incredible news, but I can't really lay it at Geraldine's feet because she's one of the widows. I can't announce it because I'm the attorney. So what he ends up doing is he calls Bill Bishop, who was in Louisville at that time. Bill is a great investigative journalist. Mm-hmm. And he says, listen, this is what I know. And 2 weeks later, Bill uncovers it all. The judge, Hermannsdorfer, will retire for medical reasons within a year or two. He had been hopeful of an appeals court seat. He finished last on the list after that little bit of news broke. And his name is not one that is still positively received. If you do any Google searching on him, there's a lot of negativity out there.
Well, listener, if you just joined us, Bill Bishop was with us earlier in this segment talking about what happened on March 9th, and you can find that part of this interview on our site at eswku.org. Well, what's your impression of how Scotia might have influenced the coal industry's sense of responsibility?
Well, you know, positive and negative. I think the coal industry has always thought of itself as caring about safety, but there's always a caveat. We care about safety, we just don't want to spend a lot of money doing it. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. I think the Mine Act of 1977 forced the coal industry to do the right thing in a couple of different ways. Number one, they were so impressed with mine rescue teams. They forced large mines to actually maintain, train, supply mine rescue teams. And Scotia, which is a shocker, Scotia actually establishes mine rescue teams. Inside of, I think, 11 or 12 years, the Scotia mine rescue team finishes second in the nation in a national competition. Mm-hmm. So they took it seriously. They really made progress. But, you know, all of this always seems to have to come with a federal and state prodding. It doesn't just grow organically.
Well, that's Dr. Brian McKnight, a professor of history at the University of Virginia in Wise, and we thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you.
You can find the full accounts of the Scotia mine disasters by Bill Bishop and Brian McKnight online at KentuckyLantern.com. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. For generations, journalism has relied on distinctly human habits of mind, curiosity, skepticism, verification, and judgment. Now, those habits are being tested by artificial intelligence, a tool that can extend the reach of reporters and editors, but it can also complicate questions of truth, transparency, and responsibility. In this episode of our series, The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril, series host Arthur Sheckett speaks with Peter Baniak, former managing editor of the Lexington Herald-Leader, and now a teacher of the next generation of journalists at the University of Kentucky. And they're going to talk about how AI is reshaping professional journalism, what's driving its adoption, and what may be at risk when speed and automation press against the discipline and time it can take to get the story right.
Welcome, Peter Baniak, to Eastern Standard and our ongoing series on artificial intelligence. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to start off with a broad question for you. You have a long and storied career in newspapers, news reporting, so your experience is broad and deep. So I want to ask you, in what ways is artificial intelligence currently impacting the practice of journalism and news reporting?
When I think about the impact of AI in journalism, I really think about it in several categories. It is affecting the business of journalism in terms of big tech and the expectations for how people encounter news, how readers find news, how they engage with the news. It is changing that very big category, which has an impact on the business of journalism and the business of news. Particularly in digital, the business of news is built around a foundation of advertising to some degree, but mostly around readers and subscribers and people finding your content. AI is changing that. I think it is changing readers' expectations about the news, because you can go to something like an LLM or an app on your phone and ask a question and get a pretty good answer that is synthesized from, you know, the entire body of knowledge of the internet by any kind of app like ChatGPT. And for a lot of readers, that really kind of changes your expectation when you can have something, you can ask a question and get a custom answer in that way, which is a little different than the experience of going and searching something on Google and having it send you a bunch of links to go read for yourself, right? So it changes reader expectations about the responsiveness of quote-unquote news, the immediacy of it, and the experience of it. And then I think the third and really big way is that it's having an impact on the craft of journalism itself. These tools are incredibly powerful. And so they open up new avenues for reporting. They open up new capabilities around reporting. They allow reporters, in my opinion, to do things that previously they haven't been able to do, or allows them to do them much, much faster than they were previously able to do. Things like number crunching and data analysis, for example.
So how are these tools affecting how news reporters are doing their work?
We're very early in this story, so to speak. And so I think a lot of journalism organizations are trying to figure out how best to use these tools. The first, and to me, the most promising, the most exciting avenue that AI tools impact journalism is data analysis. These tools allow you to take massive amounts of data, information, numbers, reports, and distill them down very quickly to help journalists analyze, find themes, find trends that previously it might have taken weeks or months for you to be able to spot. And that's incredibly powerful.
Is there a story that you worked on that comes to mind that would have been expedited by these tools?
A great example was from this wasn't in Lexington, but it was from a small newsroom that was working on a story about a climate project that was going to affect the environment in a local area. And the federal government, I think it was the federal government, it might have been the state government, opened up a public comment period. And they got thousands of pieces of public comment. And it would have taken a reporter forever to, like, look through all those, sift through all of them, categorize them. And so they were able to develop very quickly, using AI, a way to scan through them, look for trends, find similarities, find big issues that were emerging, find themes, which then allowed them to focus their reporting a lot more thoughtfully and much more quickly than they would have been able to do otherwise, which allowed them to produce a story faster. And to me, that's really the ideal here, is that you have a human journalist who brings their ethics, their knowledge, their judgment to the table using AI as a tool to more effectively report.
What about other tools, other ways that AI is being used that is helpful in terms of journalistic practice?
The other ways that I would say is that it allows journalists and reporters to be more efficient and to do routine tasks much more quickly. So there are a lot of experiments going on around the country, for example, where newsrooms are developing AI tools that allow them to monitor more government meetings without actually having to have somebody present at every one of those meetings, because that's enormously time consuming. And so you've seen multiple experiments by lots of different news organizations, including some in public media, that have built tools using AI technology that will either monitor video of public meetings, comb through transcripts of public meetings, look through meeting minutes, and spot things, issues, themes that reporters have prompted the AI to look for. And so say it's a story that you've been covering before and have told AI, okay, these are the keywords that you should be looking for. So it watches the meeting for you, in a manner of speaking, and then can send the journalist an email or a quick report or a synopsis saying, hey, this thing that you're interested in that you've written about before, guess what? It came up at this meeting that you may not have been at, and therefore it might be worth a story for you to do. There's a lot of work going on with AI tools as expanding the reporting network for local reporters. If you think of it as radar or sonar, right, it sort of broadens the scope of what you can be looking at and monitoring in a much more broad way. So there's a lot of exciting work going on in journalism organizations around that kind of expansiveness. And if you think of the impact for that for really small newsrooms, at a time when, over the last couple of decades, you know, you've seen a lot of small newsrooms get smaller. Well, a tool like that can help you expand your work and expand your scope of vision and expand the amount of journalism you do by almost acting like a tip sheet, if you will. You know, the journalist then has to pick up the ball and run with it and actually do the reporting. But if the AI can get you there faster, can flag, hey, this thing came up, or even, you know, this court case that you've been following, a major thing happened or a filing came in yesterday that you may have missed. Here it is in your email box on Monday morning. That can be a really, really powerful and helpful tool for journalists.
Are there any ways that AI is making the work more difficult or more complicated?
I would say more complicated just because of the environment that we all now inhabit. If you think about the news environment that we as news consumers inhabit, it is very easy now to produce content, anyone, anywhere, using AI tools that looks like journalism. And so I think that that is confusing, potentially. And I think that that means that real journalism, verified, vetted, thoroughly reported journalism, has to exist in the same environment, in the same social media feeds, in the same Facebook feed, in the same stream, in somebody's video, you know, in their TikTok feed, side by side with all that other stuff. And so I think it really complicates the news environment because news organizations need to do more now than ever to explain how what they are doing is different than all of this other stuff that is very easily produced and looks kind of sort of like journalism, even though it's not.
So that really impacts the end user, the reader of the news, the consumer of the news. What does the end user need to do in that kind of environment?
I would start by saying, ask questions. And, you know, this has always been the case with social media, but now more than ever in the age of AI, when it is easy, you know, that piece of video content, we've always said what seeing is believing, right? And so it's always been in the past, like, okay, if I see a photo of it or I see a video of it, then I know it to be true. Or if I hear audio of it, I know it to be true. Well, that's not always necessarily the case. So I think it's important for news consumers to say, okay, where did this come from? Did this make sense? How did it end up in my feed? Is any reputable news organization reporting this? Before you hit share of that thing that your friend shared that just popped up in your social media feed, ask some critical questions. Go to some trusted sources, because the work that journalists are doing is different than that. They are going and taking stories and tracing them back to their origin. They are talking to the people who are involved directly in them. They have information that they are then using to verify the facts of a case. And so I think it's really important to have sort of a heightened sense of news literacy before you hit that share button, more than anything. And just to be aware that there are a lot of things that are going to be showing up in your newsfeed as people discover the power of this technology that look like journalism, look like news, and may not be.
So both at the production of news content and at the absorption of news content, we need active actors in it that verify things and can filter out the slop from the real stuff. That sounds like a lot of work, actually, when AI is promising to reduce our work and make things more efficient.
And I think that's one of the biggest challenges of the age that we are in. How do we as journalists differentiate and explain? And I think it's fair to say over the last 15, 20 years that I don't know that we as a craft and as a business and as an industry have done a great job of that. I think it's more important now than ever to do that. I think it's also part of the role of journalists to report on these things. And so, you know, if there is a AI-produced video that is going viral, it is part of the job of journalists to explain that to readers. This is not real. And get to the bottom of where did it come from? Why is it being produced? What is the purpose behind it? Why is it being sent out there? So there's an emerging and really a lot of good work being done by journalists about the AI business and big tech itself in terms of the impact it has on not just sort of what appears in your social media feed, but other issues like energy consumption, water consumption, and data centers, and those sorts of things.
How are legacy news organizations coping with the velocity of the change that what we're calling the AI revolution is bringing?
Right. First, a lot of news organizations have set sort of guardrails around their own use of AI. And I think that that's been a really important and valuable first step. And I think also something looking at it from the consumer's perspective, the consumer of news, a reader, it's really important to kind of know what those guardrails are of the media that you ingest and trust. And so a lot of news sites are publishing as an amendment or something that's connected to their ethics policy. Here's how we're using AI. Here's how we're going to be transparent when we do use AI. Here are the things we are not using AI for. And then on individual pieces of content, if AI has had an impact, being clear and transparent about that. I think reputable news organizations, you know, have had to do a lot of thinking and a lot of fast movement around that to make that really clear.
But there are no ground rules currently. There are no regulations that govern all this. So everything is sort of being adjusted to on the fly. Is that correct?
In terms of like broad federal rules, there are some states that have passed regulations around AI and AI disclosures and those sorts of things. But in terms of like broad regulation of big tech and AI businesses, no.
So the consumer really has to be an active actor here in terms of accessing news content and reporting content.
An active actor and a thoughtful actor in terms of, you know, how is AI being used in this case? And I would say in terms of reputable newsrooms, they're going to disclose to you AI was used in the following way. And it may be a big way or maybe a little way. But I think as a news consumer, that's something that you need to know, and it's something you should want to know in those cases. And so I think that's something you can look for is that use disclosed?
So that's kind of a verification tool that the end user can use to discern what's the real stuff versus the slop.
Exactly. And I would say if you look at a lot of, again, reputable news organizations in terms of when they have drafted these guardrails or these policies around AI use, there are kind of pretty consistent themes. One is, you know, we are going to experiment. This technology is impactful enough. It's big enough, it's important enough that you as an organization can't just put your head in the sand. You have to experiment with it. You have to see how can it help us do more journalism? How can it help us do better journalism? How can it help us? So a lot of sites are being very clear, you know, we're experimenting with this technology. The second step in that, though, is to flag for readers, here's how you'll know. Here's how we're going to be transparent about that. You know, we're going to signal it through some sort of graphical icon, or we're going to tell you exactly how we used it, whatever that is. And the third that you commonly see in a lot of these policies is that human beings are going to stay in the mix. While the AI is helping us as a tool, human journalists are the decision makers, the final editors. They're the source of judgment, the final call, if you will, in terms of whatever it is, in whatever way they are using AI tools.
So I wanted to end up here with questions about the education of the next generation of journalists. You've mm-hmm. just started teaching at UK in the journalism department, the School of Communication. And I'm wondering how the training of the next generation of journalists is changing or needs to change.
So I think that that is evolving just as, you know, you're seeing that in a lot of industries. You're seeing that in things like coding. It's sort of a similar as what you're seeing in journalism. I think the interesting thing is that this is technology that students are using, right? They're already using it. And that consumers are using and that readers are using and the general public is using. You're using it on your phone. You're using it on a regular basis. So I think a lot of the conversation is about how do you then teach aspiring journalists to use it with the same ethical thoughtfulness that they use other tools or do other actions in the course of reporting a story. So I think putting that kind of ethical framework and that sort of strong ethical thinking is a critical part of that question. How do you use it ethically? How do you use it thoughtfully? How do you use it responsibly? And then the other piece of it, as I said before, is it's a tool. And so I think there are skills that can be taught around using these tools. But the other thing that is like really exciting about AI is that you can also build your own tools. And so, you know, a lot of that challenge for anyone who's using this, not just journalists, but, okay, what do you want this technology to help you accomplish? You don't have to be a coder. That's part of the power here, is that you don't have to be someone who knows how to code. The AI will help you do that piece to get to where you want to go, but you have to guide it. And so I think training and teaching in schools, again, not just for journalists, but for students generally, how do you use this tool? How do you use these tools ethically, thoughtfully? And this is a little bit of an art, as much as it is science. And if you've ever had to prompt and reprompt and ask an app like ChatGPT to do what you're trying to get it to do. So, you know, working with students to develop those instincts and that art and that science, I think, is another really interesting and kind of fascinating area of instruction.
The title of this series is The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril. What do you think is the singular promise of AI in terms of journalistic practice and the singular peril of AI?
There are so many. I will try to pick one, though. So power, I would say, sort of back to what I was talking about before, I think these are incredibly powerful reporting tools. They allow, and you see this, you know, the last couple of years, the Pulitzer Prizes, the highest award in journalism, have asked entities that are entering work that uses AI to disclose that, as they should. And there have been some really powerful pieces of journalism produced with the help of AI, usually around things like data analysis or visual presentation of their findings. And that, to me, is really very powerful. And I think that the ability to use these tools to do more reporting, to do really powerful reporting about issues that matter, is what I would identify as the singular thing on that front. In peril, I think it is, in many ways, an existential threat to news and how people consume it. You know, if you think about things like what I was describing at the first part of this conversation, you know, 5 years ago, if you went to Google and asked a question or put in a search term, you know, you were going to get a long list of links that would, in many cases, take you to news sites. And that is an important part of the news ecosystem. That is an important part of the news business model. Well, now, if you go and ask Google a question, it's going to give you an AI summary before you ever see a link. That fundamentally changes the transactional part of how people get, consume, and whether they make a decision to go to that news site. A lot of news sites are very heavily dependent on search traffic coming to them from places like Google. So that changes that. That changes the nature of that. And so that part of it, the production of content and the rules around intellectual property and those sorts of things that are produced by journalists, but then are sort of scooped up by these large language models and then repackaged to answer questions, that changes a lot about the delivery mechanism and the way that people experience news. And so I think that if I were to look at sort of a potential peril, how all of that sorts itself out is really, really important.
Peter Benyak, I want to really thank you a lot for coming on and sharing your expertise and your knowledge and all of your experience about journalism. This is Art Sheckett for Eastern Standard.
Weaving has a storied history in Appalachia. The Cherokee and Shawnee developed their own robust weaving traditions. European settlers brought their own styles of weaving. These days, fiber artists in Appalachia are noticing something new. There's new interest. So they're making the craft more accessible to beginners. Reporter Toni Doman, herself a weaver, has the story.
I'm in Kingsport, Tennessee, and it's the final day of an Intro to Hand Weaving course hosted by the Overmountain Weavers Guild. I've been in the class all month. We're in a room full of floor looms, and there's about 15 students, ranging in age from 12 to over 70. Guild member Marita Schwartz welcomes everyone to class.
I know from sitting here that what you most want to do is go to your loom. So we're going to let you weave for a while.
The loom is the primary tool in weaving. It's used to create a pattern of interlocking sets of threads that eventually results in a piece of cloth. I'm in my 30s and started weaving 2 years ago. I live in nearby Bristol, Virginia, and I wanted the chance to grow my skills in person, so I joined this class. Today, Schwartz is helping me create the fringe on a table runner.
Hold it. Pull these out. You don't have to.
The Overmountain Weavers Guild started over 50 years ago. They host monthly meetings and workshops about different fiber arts. It's become an important source of community for artists in the area. The Guild's emphasis on in-person learning has inspired a new crop of weavers.
When I started weaving, I expected to like it, but I've enjoyed it so much more, and every new thing I do, I just get so excited about.
Mark Archibald is from Marion, Virginia. He took the class last year, then joined the Guild and returned this year as one of the instructors.
Every time I'm around another weaver, I'm trying to look over their shoulder and see, how do you do that?
In addition to creating opportunities to learn in person, other weavers are focused on making the craft more accessible to younger learners. One of those people is Erin Miller. She's the director of weaving at Berea College in Kentucky. Miller's in her 30s and has been weaving for the past 16 years.
I'm on the board of the Hand Weavers Guild of America, which is primarily older hobby weavers. And that's changing. And part of the reason that I'm on the board is because I'm really interested in seeing that demographic change.
And Miller is seeing that demographic change. Most of her students are college-aged and come from diverse backgrounds. Miller believes we're in a period of revived interest in weaving here in Appalachia. She says it has to do with what's going on at a societal level.
It feels like a really kind of chaotic and tumultuous time. And we as human beings are trying as much as possible to find joy in our lives. And there are a lot of people that find joy and meaning in physically making something.
Deborah Prescott is a weaver based in Bristol, Virginia. She agrees with Miller that weaving seems to be a kind of antidote that people are seeking out in current times.
It is interesting how people sense that, the connection to the past. And that gives a feeling of rootedness, which is something that we have so lost in our current way of life.
Prescott has lived in Bristol for over 30 years. During that time, she's seen more people in the region become interested in weaving. In fact, over the last year, she's become my mentor.
Deborah, what do you enjoy most about becoming my mentor in this craft journey?
It has just really shown me how much each generation needs the other. To find someone who appreciates what you've learned, what you value, and wants to carry that forward, that is a treasure.
For Eastern Standard, I'm Toni Doman.
The story was produced and edited by Nicole Musgrave and Susanna Brown and was originally reported for the Rural Remix, a podcast from the Center for Rural Strategies. Thanks for joining us. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions and is now heard on Louisville's WFPL, Saturday mornings at 7. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.